If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Ian Plimer is an Australian geologist and professor emeritus. He returns to RCR. We've had him on before on this program and on the Greenwashed show. And he's here to discuss the potential for mitigating an explosion in the Great Artesian Basin, Australia. He's done a recent piece in The Spectator highlighting concerns regarding that proposed injection of liquid carbon dioxide into the Great Artesian Basin, a proposal from a Swiss mining company. And he suggests alternative solutions to mitigate potential risks and challenges the prevailing beliefs regarding carbon dioxide emissions and global warming. And we know about those beliefs. Ian Plimer beams in from Australia. Ian, it's good to have you on our program again.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, well, we don't mind that. Now, I'm really curious. Describe or give us some sort of outline of what the Great Artesian Basin is, where it's located, and kind of its role, what it means. Really interested to know about that.
Well, the Great Artesian Basin covers 22% of Australia, and it covers bits of South Australia, Northern Territory, New South Wales, and Queensland. It occupies or covers about 65% of Queensland. And the Great Artesian Basin is used for artesian waters, which come from a rock unit called the precipice sandstone. And those artesian waters are used for stock. They're used for some town potable water, and it's used for irrigation. And in some places, if you're lucky, the precipice sandstone's got oil and gas in it. So some of the early oil discoveries in Australia were from the Great Artesian Basin. It is the lifeline of Queensland. It provides water for Queensland. Eastern Queensland is tropical and gets heavy rain, but central and western Queensland relies on underground water. So the Great Artesian Basin is the water for many pastoralists. About 180,000 people rely on that water to survive, and many towns use that water to survive. So it is one of the biggest basins in the world, and the aquifer in the Great Artesian Basin is the biggest freshwater aquifer in the world.
Wow.
So it's pretty important.
Yeah. So give us an idea of that sort of natural structure. How far below the ground is it? There must be a massive quantity of water sitting in there, I'm imagining.
There is. There's an absolutely monstrous quantity of water, and the eastern edge of the Great Artesian Basin, it outcrops, the precipice sandstone outcrops, and there water comes in on the eastern and the northern part and comes into the sandstone and it flows westerly, and it can flow up to 200 metres a day. In the western part of the Great Artesian Basin in South Australia, the water is 2 million years old, and that water leaks out in springs, these warm springs, give mounds of salts and clays, and these mound springs have got vegetation of very, very special ecology, and these are right out in the middle of the desert. These are areas that get about 3 inches a year of rain, yet there's water and there's fresh water. So these mound springs have been known for thousands of years. The water is nice and warm. There's a wonderful ecology that develops around them. So we know that the water flows in the precipice sandstone, and we know that it leaks out fractures and faults and cracks in the rocks above the Great Artesian Basin aquifer. The aquifer is at surface at the east, and at the deepest part of the Great Artesian Basin, it's at about 3 kilometres depth.
Wow, okay.
And the water, there are more than 10,000 bores that have been put into the Great Artesian Basin, and these have been put in since 1878. And in early times, these bores were just let run free so the water could cool down and the stock could use it. So the aquifer, the water level in the Great Artesian Basin has dropped about 100 metres. And in some places, the water rises halfway up the bore and then needs to be pumped for the rest of the way. Now, the water is generally pretty warm, normally at about 90 degrees Celsius. Deep in the basin, it's about 130 degrees Celsius. And this is artesian water, which comes to the surface under its own pressure. So not only is it at high temperature, it's also at high pressure.
Right. And the temperature is because of the depth, right? The further you go in depth, the hotter it gets. And it heats up quite a bit in quick time, doesn't it?
It does. And water is a great carrier of heat compared with the air. So if you think about the planet's climate, it's not the atmosphere that holds the heat. It's the actually the oceans. And in the Great Artesian Basin, most of the heat is geothermal heat. And as you get deeper, you get more heat. A little bit of it is heat that derives from radioactivity, that there are some minerals there, potassium minerals, that give out a little bit of heat. And this is well known. The potassium compounds always have a slight radioactivity. So if you want to have a good dose of radioactivity, there are two things you can do. You can either eat a lot of bananas or you can entwine yourself in the naked body of another person overnight, and you will get a good dose. And I'm talking about a dose of radiation.
Okay. Should I have one of those Geiger counters by the bed just in case?
Oh, that could be embarrassing.
Yeah. What's that? We'll talk about that later.
It could be a performance meter. Who knows?
Yeah, with a little dial thing on
dial.
It. The age of it interests me. You said 2 million years. So does that mean that water's, I mean, obviously it must circulate kind of, but that's just been sitting there all that time, has it?
It's been flowing westwards for at least 2 million years, and it comes out at the surface through natural bore springs in the far northeastern part of South Australia, in the far west of the Great Artesian Basin. So it does flow.
And working out where it actually is that, how's that done? Is it like penetrating ground, penetrating radar, or what, do they drill big holes? Because up to 3K is a long way down.
It is. Normally water is traced by measuring flow in bores, and you can sometimes put in a fluorescein dye, which then you can measure. It comes out the next bore, and you can work out the rate of flow. But you can work it out from the porosity and permeability of the host sandstone, the precipice sandstone, which is the aquifer. And you can date the age of the water, because you can date when the water was at the surface getting exposed to radiation from sunlight. And it produces a type of chlorine which only forms from radioactive action from cosmic rays and solar rays hitting it. And so you measure this chlorine 36 in the water that comes up the bores, and you can back calculate the age. So there's some pretty nifty ways of working out the age of it. You can also work out the age by looking at fluid flow, how quickly it flows in the aquifer. So the radioactive age has been validated.
And you said at the, and we'll get on to the other stuff in just a moment, but you said the level had, what, dropped around 100 metres in, what, historical time of...
Yeah, since 1878,
And that's from, what, just bores and use. So what sort of volume, we're just again, trying to think about the physics of that, what sort of volume of water is that to be used?
Well, the number is 65,000 gigalitres, which doesn't mean very much, but since 1878, water has been allowed to flow up these artesian bores. It comes up under its own pressure, and it was just let run out to the surface. It was, in former times, 100 years or so ago, regarded as an infinite source of water. Well, it isn't. And now there's fairly strict regulations on the use of this water. And in some places, some of the towns in northern New South Wales have bore bars, and these are virtually thermal springs of artesian water where people can go and wallow in the water and think it gives them extra life. And occasionally the water has a massive pong to it, and this is rotten egg gas, which is in the water. At other times there's methane in the water, and you can set light to the bores and the methane burns, and people say it's the end of the world, but the methane is exploited in some other bores, and it forms part of the natural gas that comes out of the bores.
And when you give it age, 2 million years, that's how long the water's been there. Of course, the water's been around since Well, the material that makes the water has been around since the Big Bang, I take it.
Well, yes, it's been flowing in the Artesian Basin, which is a basin full of old sediments, which are now sedimentary rocks. And it's a basin that's been there for a couple of hundred million years. And the water has been flowing westwards and then coming out at the surface. So it takes 2 million years to get from one side of the basin to the other.
Good things take time, I suppose. Now, what is this? I mean, just a quick glance at this proposal. The proposed injection of liquid carbon dioxide into this great Artesian Basin. What's all that about? Why does anyone want to do that?
Well, the Swiss mining company, Glencore, has mines, coal mines. It also has power stations or relationships with power stations. And what it wants to do is to collect the carbon dioxide from a power station and to use about 20% of the energy that's developed in this power station to compress the carbon dioxide and bring it down to low temperature, and it becomes a liquid. And then they want to transport that liquid in tankers a couple of hundred kilometres and put it down an old bore into the Great Artesian Basin as liquid carbon dioxide. They have to put it down as pressure to push aside the water that's filling up the pores in that precipice sandstone, and they want to leave it there. That's their method of carbon sequestration, and they hope to hell that nothing goes wrong. Well, what could go wrong? Well, of course, there can be a lot that goes wrong. And carbon dioxide is a gas which we geologists study a lot because we are interested in carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide water mixes because they flash. And this is where you go from a liquid to a gas instantaneously, and that flashing is a massive explosion. And with flashing, you have the expansion of about 300 times the volume. This material then moves up to the surface and fractures and breaks rocks and blasts material out in a gas volcano. Now, in New Zealand, you've got many volcanoes where you have liquid rock or magma, but there are also gas volcanoes where there's no liquid rock. We see evidence of gas volcanoes that have existed in the Great Artesian Basin. When you go down some of the opal mines, you can see these great zones of broken up rock. We geologists love gas volcanoes because around these you often find gold and copper deposits. So we look for these actively, and sometimes...
Are they pushed up? Are they ejected from deeper...
It's material that's in solution, and when you expand that solution enormously, then anything dissolved in it will drop out of solution. And so it's a mechanism of concentrating gold or concentrating gold and copper. So we like these gas volcanoes. I've looked at them in many parts of the world, mainly in Iran, but in eastern Australia there are quite a few of them. And with any of the gold deposits, such as those that you have in the Coromandel Peninsula, those have a very large amount of gas. It's associated with the fluid that carried the gold in solution. And as soon as you change the chemistry of that water or expand it or boil it or explode it, you dump out the gold. So we're pretty interested in this sort of stuff. We've been looking at it for years. I'm currently looking at it in Ecuador. So we know that if you hold carbon dioxide under pressure at temperature and at a great depth, it will find a weakness in the rocks and it will start to exploit that weakness, expand and explode. And this is the worry we have for the Great Artesian Basin. And, of course, your listeners will think, this bloke's exaggerating, this fellow is completely off the planet. Well, I'm sorry, folks. We have two very good examples, one in 1984 and the one you probably know about in 1986 from Lake Neos in Africa and Lake Neos in Cameroon. On the 21st of August 1986, it leaked out carbon dioxide in an explosion. Now, the carbon dioxide came out of water. It was in solution in very, very deep cold water in the lake. And on a very still night, it leaked out, exploded to the surface, and we filled valleys with carbon dioxide, which is heavier than air. It pushed aside the air. people had no air to breathe, so they asphyxiated, and the stock and other wildlife had nothing to breathe, and they died. So there were almost 2,000 people who died. There were 3,500 stock, and God knows how many wildlife died with just one burp from Lake Neos in Cameroon. So my concern is that we are creating exactly this setting for a burp to come out of the Great Artesian Basin, this burp of carbon dioxide, where we've converted liquid carbon dioxide into gas, which is greatly expanded, blasted its way to the surface, would actually then fill valleys on a quiet night. Most of the towns in Western Queensland, and there are 120 of them, are in valleys, and so they would be blanketed with carbon dioxide. People, stock, animals wouldn't have anything to breathe, and they would asphyxiate. Now, we've seen it before, and
it's a horror.
It'll happen again.
Yeah.
This was never considered. I've looked at all the Glencore reports, technical reports on this. I've looked at the government reports on the Great Artesian Basin. And in Australia, the upper house or the Senate in the federal government is having an inquiry. I've made a submission to the inquiry. The Queensland state government has also to make a decision sometime at the end of May. And I suspect that these decisions won't be driven by common sense. They will be driven by the fact that there is a state election on in Queensland in October, and we have to have a federal election in Australia before May of next year. So we've lost all semblance of common sense. We're trying to save the planet by putting plant food underground, and we're, like many of these other harebrained schemes, we're not looking at all the consequences.
What sort of quantities are we talking about, you know, as an output from what was the power generation and all the other activities? And when does it get serious? When, you know, at what level of quantity does it, this problem become a serious problem?
Well, they're thinking of 330,000 tons of liquid carbon dioxide. That in itself is pretty serious. So there is an experiment to put this in the ground, and my fear is that they'll put it in the ground, say, oh, nothing can go wrong, what's the problem, and keep doing it. And I have a few problems with that. For the last 500 million years, since we've had complex life on Earth, we've actually been decreasing in carbon dioxide. The atmosphere's gone from 0.7% to the current level of 0.04%. And that's because we've used carbon dioxide in plants, which ends up as coal. That's because it ends up in oil or limestone or in shells or in fossils. And we've sequestered carbon dioxide naturally. And so we have had a massive decrease in planetary carbon dioxide for the last 500 million years. If we halved it, then we would kill off all vegetation. So in order to save the planet, we really have to feed the plants. Now, I'm of the age where my girth has increased. I'm not really able to hug a tree because my girth stops me doing it. Right. But I like to feed trees, and so I give them carbon dioxide. And so I think we should be thinking seriously about feeding the planet and feeding the trees and not locking this carbon dioxide away forever,
but putting it into the atmosphere. Yeah, right. Yeah. But that would trigger majorly a lot of people, Ian, given what the narrative is.
Well, it's very easy to trigger unbalanced people. All you've got to do is look them in the eye and they get nervous. It would trigger a lot of people, but these people don't realise that no one has ever shown that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming. And if you could show it, then you'd have to show that the natural emissions, which are 97% of the total, don't drive global warming. Now, I've been asking scientists who basically make their money out of frightening us witless on climate matters. I've been asking them for a decade now, please give me half a dozen scientific papers that demonstrate that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming. My latest tussle has been with a senior scientist at the Scott Polar Institute at Cambridge University in the UK. He's written a couple of books on climate. And whenever I ask this question, I get obfuscation or I get abuse. I have never had that simple question answered. Can you please give me half a dozen scientific papers that demonstrate that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming? And I argue that this whole carbon dioxide scare is a house of cards. And to flush these people out, I think we put carbon dioxide back where it came from, and that's into the atmosphere. Anyone who's a horticulturalist will burn propane and pump in warm carbon dioxide and water vapour into their glasshouse. And if you have about 2.5 to 3 times the current atmospheric carbon dioxide content, then the plants really thrive. We've known this for hundreds of years, that carbon dioxide is plant food. And I can't see why we should all of a sudden, on a matter of a whim and a political ideology, reject what we've known and demonstrated for a long period of time.
It's interesting what you say, the reaction that you just mentioned, obfuscation, I can understand. But abuse, where does that come from?
Well, it comes from people who don't have an answer.
Right. It makes them angry, right? Winds them up.
I'm made angry. And as a scientist, your job is to ask questions. And these questions need to be questions framed around data and around evidence. I'm not interested in opinion. I'm interested in the data. And a good scientist will say, oh, that's interesting. I'm curious. I'm going to pursue this some more. There is no such thing as consensus in science. Consensus is what we have in politics and religion. There's no such thing.
Consensus is the enemy, isn't it, in a way? Because that's where groupthink comes from, and that can take you completely down the wrong track.
Well, very much so. And we've had in science a consensus in the past. We once had a consensus that the sun rotated around the earth. That was wrong. We once had a consensus that the continents didn't move. That was wrong. We can measure them moving. They move up to 10 centimetres a year.
Well, especially when they look like they fit together, a lot of them. It's a bit of a tell, isn't it?
Well, it took 100 years for that concept to be established in the literature. We once thought that the atom was the smallest unit in the universe. We once then thought that the electron was the smallest unit in the universe. We now think that the smallest units are subatomic particles. So many, many times we've had a consensus in science. We once had a consensus that on creation of all organisms. Now we have a view and many, many views based on evolution.
Darwinism is actually not standing up too well these days. I'm hearing a lot of people question, that platform as an idea.
Well, I think we should. I've spent a lot of my life, and in fact, I wrote a book once about evolution and creationism, which I called Telling Lies for God. I think we should question everything, even if it's the established science. Now, there are some times that you don't want to question it too much. For example, I have flown in aeroplanes a lot. I average 3 flights a week, and I think I understand how a wing works, but I don't want to question it too much just as I'm taking off.
You just hope it works.
Well, I don't hope. I mean, there are tens of thousands of takeoffs every month, so I think I can be pretty
But
certain.
It's not magic. It's not magic.
It isn't magic at all. No. So consensus isn't science. Agreement is not part of science. True science is vibrant and there's disagreement. You come up with a conclusion, but that is an interim conclusion, and that is interim until you get better data or have another think. Now, I've had to do that myself in my own science. I'm an expert in one particular field. People used to quote me. And then I started to rethink and go back and collect more data, and I realised I was absolutely, totally, bloody wrong. So I published, criticising my earlier work, and I think I'm a bit more savage on myself than other authors would have been, and I think that's what true science is about, is you never have the answer, but you get closer to it all the time, And science is married to evidence.
I've heard scientists say, you know, because I've watched quite a few interviews, I'm interested in that sort of thing. Some say they want to be wrong, actually, because that forces a movement in knowledge, right? Knock yourself out. Tell me I'm wrong. I want to hear I'm wrong. Yeah. You know.
Well, I used to do that with all my PhD students. I'd say, well, this is what I've published. Show that I'm wrong. And you know, some of the little turds actually showed that I was wrong. I mean, isn't that terrible? And
it's a learning experience for them.
Well, and for me too. Yeah, and yeah. This is what I think is missing in the current cacophony about climate. There has never been a debate. And there is an ideology. The words consensus are used. People count the number of people that believe in climate change. Now, belief is a word of politics and religion. We don't put up a hand and vote as to whether we believe that gravity works or not. We look at the evidence and we repeat the evidence and we collect more evidence. And you've only got to get one strand of evidence to show that the hypothesis is wrong, and then you have to throw out the hypothesis. Now, in geology, we've probably got 20 strands of evidence that show that human-induced climate change is absolutely and totally wrong. And the best evidence are from the cycles of climate that we see, from plate tectonics every 400 million years, from galactic activity every 143 million years, and from orbital changes every 100,000, 40,000, and 20,000 years, changes in the sun every 22 years, 217 years, 1,500 years, and 10,000 years. We've got cycles upon cycles upon cycles. And we can go back in time and see these cycles. And these cycles are absolutely and totally unrelated to the gas of life, carbon dioxide. So we have a huge amount of evidence to show that the hypothesis that humans drive a major planetary process is wrong, yet it's not listened to. So the whole climate catastrophe movement has got nothing to do with science. It's got nothing to do with the environment. Just look at the damage that's done with wind and solar facilities parked all over the place. It's all to do with unelected people in power trying to have power over you and your wallet. It's not science.
Getting back to the this idea of injecting the liquid carbon dioxide into the Great Artesian Basin, I take it there's no solid scientific evidence that that's the thing to do either, right? Going the other way. Have you seen anything being produced to support the argument, apart from it being out of sight, out of mind, right, if it's pushed into the earth?
Well, they put up no valid arguments. They have put up the proposal, very much supported by governments. And governments like the idea of destroying the planet to save it. It looks as if they're doing something. There's some very simple chemistry showing that if you dissolve carbon dioxide in water, you get carbonic acid. And in the Great Artesian Basin, you will dissolve out arsenic, cadmium and lead, which will end up in irrigation water and drinking water. That sounds like a pretty bright idea to me. Hmm. So it's basically governments saying, yes, we are having this carbon capture scheme because we want to get rid of this horrible plant food, this food that we all absolutely desperately need for life on Earth.
Yeah. Just to finish up, I'm curious, you mentioned that disaster in Africa and the sort of big burp coming up through a lake. What would that have been like? Would that have been obvious if you were watching the lake? Would there have been some disturbance that would have been obvious? What would have happened there?
Well, it happened at night and there was clearly a lot of disturbance in the lake because what was clear blue water the next morning was brown and muddy, and there'd been a lot of disturbance. Since then, there have been discharge points put in the lake where pipes go down into the bottom cold water, which has got a lot of carbon dioxide in it, and the water is vented. It's also happening in some of the other Rift Valley lakes in East Africa. It's happening in Cameroon. So we now know that this is due, in that case, to a supersaturation of carbon dioxide in cold bottom water. That's not the scene that would happen in the Great Artesian Basin. So it's been very, very well studied, and there's been a big movement to stop it happening again by constantly venting carbon dioxide out of that lake out of their crater lake into the atmosphere.
One final question. When does this, well, what is the timeline? Are you aware of this proposal? How soon do they want to do it, and how quickly a decision is going to be made? And is there enough power pushing back, like yourself and others, I would assume, to kind of, you know, bring them to some sort of sense, let's say?
Well, there is a process taking place, and that process will probably finish at the end of the year. However, there's a lot of pushback from people who don't count. And in Australia, like in New Zealand, we don't value our farmers. We do not value them at all, because most of the population now in Australia, they're not bronze Anzacs with rippling muscles. These are people who are living in the cities, who are captured by a screen. They don't get outside. They don't have calluses on their hand. They don't work on the land or in a mine. And so they don't understand where their food and their fibre and their energy and their metals and their fish come from. They have no idea. So the bulk of the electorate now, thank you for having me, people who get their information off a screen, and the rural electorates don't have many people. They don't have a big political voice. And so it's fairly hard for rural people not to actually get crushed by the burden of regulation, by the red tape and the green tape and the black tape and now the blue tape from the UN. And so we have a real problem in Australia that we are a highly urbanised society with people who live in apartments. They have no idea how the world works, yet they have political power over people who are actually producers, who take huge risks, who've kept a family farm going for generations. And so we have this large amount of people in rural and regional and outback Australia who are disenfranchised. So it is a battle.
It's been fascinating having you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I got all sorts of other questions about other matters in your zone too, because the whole thing interests me, and I know many of our listeners. Thanks for making some time, and we'll follow this and see kind of what happens over that time frame that you mentioned. Thanks for coming on, Ian Plimer.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.